How's it going, everybody? Welcome to the Dead Jester Productions podcast, episode number 217. I'm your host, Josh, or Jay Moskers, joined this week by special guest, John Lumcare. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Appreciate you taking the time, stopping by. I know it's late where you're at. Why don't you tell people a little bit about yourself, what you have going on, what it is you do?
So I'm John Lumcare. I live in London. I'm an animation director. Been doing that for many years, and I'm at the moment in the process of trying to get an animated sitcom off the ground. Nice. It's called Jazz Cow, and I don't know. I'm realizing I don't know how much I should say, so I'm just
hard stop. No, that's awesome. How old, I guess I'll start with it, because I have a question to bring up, a follow-up, I guess, to that. How old were you when you started doing animation?
So I started, as most people who are animators at the moment, I started with flickbooks as a child. I just loved to kind of tell stories and draw stuff. And so that was probably from the age of about 8 or 9. I'm making up the ages, but it's probably about that. Mm-hmm. And then, but doing it professionally, I guess from about my early 20s.
Nice. Yeah, I did. I do not do animation. Let me put that out there right away. I have no skill for this, but I did when I was in, I don't know how old I would have been, 12, 13, maybe slightly younger than that. I got interested in doing the stick figure animations. I don't remember the program name. It's been 20 years almost. But I just remember it's like you literally did it frame by frame, one of those. And I got really interested in that for a while because it's nowhere near as complicated as what you do, obviously, where I'm literally just animating a stick figure and then a couple of little background objects, essentially. And I got really invested in that, and I tried getting into more complex animation and realized that it took a lot of work.
Oh, it's too much work. Yeah. And it's still frame by frame. People always think that is gone, but actually you still have to go frame by frame to do certain things.
Do you use like one of the maybe different brands, like I forget how it's pronounced, like a Wacom or like a Wacom tablet?
Yeah, I have maybe a cheap sort of I have a cheap Chinese knockoff of a Wacom tablet.
Oh, okay.
I do have an old Wacom tablet, but this one is one with the screen that you can actually see.
I have one of the ones that doesn't have the screen. I bought that years ago, and it was interesting. It's just unfortunate that I'm terrible at drawing.
it exacerbates your problems, I think.
Not being able to draw and not being able to draw on the same screen you're animating on. Where I'm literally writing with one hand and then looking up at a different screen trying to see what it is I'm doing. It's probably not the most convenient way to get started on that,
but it gets more intuitive over time.
I imagine so. I probably would have had to give it a fair shot. I mean, I still have it in my closet here in the office. I could always try it up again if I found the time and means to make it happen. But so you got started at a young age doing some of the more simpler ones, and you got into it more professionally as you got a little bit older. Was that your goal, like from when you were a kid then to like you were really interested in doing that, like animation and just the creative work in general?
Yeah.
So were you always thinking like, oh, this is what I want to do, this is what I want to be?
Yeah. Ever since I can really remember, I wanted to be an animator, wanted to tell stories, wanted to draw pictures. So that was the direction I headed off and kind of got there.
I can really appreciate the fact that you actually at least went for it. I know I work with a lot of different people on a daily basis where they're like, yeah, I want to do this, but you know, here I am. It's like, I will do it, I guess. You know, you're never going to succeed. You're only going to fail. You know, unless you try, you have to at least go for it. And a lot of people don't go for it because they're worried about failing or, you know, one thing or another, whatever it is.
You're guaranteed money. To fail, and you're guaranteed to not earn very much money. But
yeah.
It's, I guess it's those that are most obsessed are going to be the ones that do it.
Mm-hmm.
That they're willing to forgo earning money in order to keep doing this very strange job.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, some of the people I deal with are like, the one guy wants to make like handmade mandolins, like the instrument.
Wow.
He makes them from scratch. He actually does do it, but like as a hobby on the side. He wants that to be his career, but it makes sense. Like, I don't blame him. You know, he has a family, his wife, kids. I can see how it'd be very nerve-wracking being the breadwinner of the family to just quit what you do and pick up your hobby as a full-time job. It could be nerve-wracking, and I don't blame him for not going for it necessarily, but I do tell him, like, you should just put in some extra hours into it and try and make your hobby into a career, like a second job, essentially, if that's what you really want to do.
Yeah, I've got a friend who studied instrument making, and he's not made a career of it. He now works in a hospital. So
it's a different career path.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's scary. Like, I'm on the cusp of doing self-employment, and I'm still just like, when do I take the jump? You know, and one of the holdups now is planning a wedding. It's expensive.
Yeah.
I've been talking to people like
time consuming, right?
I mean, my fiance is handling most of the planning because I'm not overly invested in the small little details of it. I'm more of the big picture side of it, where it's like, yeah, these are some of the things I'd be interested in for food. This is where we can have it, whatever. And these are the people we can invite. I don't really care what color the napkins are or the place settings.
Yeah, but fair enough.
I've been joking with people that she's like a used car salesman, where I go up and think it's going to be easy and cheap. And then I walk away like, oh, I've taken out like a massive loan, and I've got a lemon of a vehicle that I'm having to put all sorts of repairs into.
As long as you don't.
Cost than I thought.
As long as the wedding doesn't eclipse the marriage. That's always the thing I always say.
Yeah. That's kind of been my approach in general to it. I was like, I don't really care about the wedding day too much. Like, the relationship itself is more important to me. To be fair, we're having it in October, and at this point, all we really need to do is, like, we have our menu and everything ready. We have a tasting coming up, and so we're just going to do that. And then, assuming that goes well, that's literally this weekend. Assuming that goes well, we'll have the menu all set up. So it's literally just a matter of sending out the invites and then waiting for people to let us know they're coming. And we're pretty much done.
That's great.
So I'm happy. We started planning at the beginning of this year. So 3 months is, I think, a quick turnaround time for planning a wedding. So I can't complain too much other than the cost. I'm a little annoyed. bringing it back sort of on topic, the reason I brought up Virgin was like, that's part of my hesitancy to do full self-employment because it's expensive. I don't I'm not in debt because of it, but like, you pay in like chunks for a wedding, obviously, like the down payment stuff. Like, I don't like owing people money and then be like, all right, cool, well, I'm gonna take a huge financial risk by basically running myself as a company.
It's
nerve-wracking, which it's not the same, but I imagine that there's similarities between that and working as like anything in the entertainment industry in general. I feel like a lot of times it's like contract work, essentially. You have actors, animators, editors, sound design, all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting this talking about the wedding. When I got married, my wife was actually unemployed at the time, and I don't have a reliable income. So we were trying to find somewhere to live, and that was tricky. But it all worked out. And she got a job, and I had work coming in, and we found somewhere. So, yeah.
Yeah, a couple of people I work with on like a daily basis, they're like, yeah, you should just go to the courthouse and do it that way. I'm like, that would be substantially cheaper. And the one guy and his wife just eloped They ran off. He's from Belgium, and they looked and came over to him. He came over to America with his wife.
Wow.
I was like, that is a jump.
Takes some adjustment.
Yeah. I think, to be fair, his wife is from America, from the US, but she had, I'm not going to go into his whole backstory. I think that's how they met somehow. Mm. You know, she's over there for university or something, but yeah, huge adjustment, Belgium to the United States.
Yeah.
I would imagine just immediately after your wedding. But I was going to ask, like, what your experience has been like working in animation as a career. Like, how do you go about even doing that? Do you put like a portfolio together essentially and then just reach out to every business you can? Like, hey, are you working on animation? Like, potentially bring me in? Like, how does that work for you?
Yeah, so there's kind of two routes. There's the one route where you try to get a job with a company, which is the more conventional route. Well, three really. And then there's the kind of freelance route, which is probably the most common one.
Mm-hmm.
And then the route I went was to start a company, and a few of us grouped together and we reached out to companies, got our portfolio together, approached people and saw if anyone got in contact. And then we did get some work in early on, which was good, but that then dried up. And then we were like, oh, how do we get clients? So then we were, that became quite a scary time early on, but then we started to get clients coming in and they would recommend other people, and people would see something we did and say, oh, who did that? Can we get you guys in? And that was our story, really.
Nice. Yeah, it can be tricky, I imagine. It's, but like I said, I don't have any experience with working with the animation side of things, but like the business-to-business style, like negotiation I do. And it's tricky because obviously you want to create the best possible outcome for both parties involved, while at the same time basically asking them to help you get more work to an extent where it's like, hey, you know, if you know anyone else, let them know, or, you know, connect us, whatever. It's networking while you're, you know, working on the job at times. And I don't know what your experience has been like, but like I've done a lot of like cold calling essentially for business to business work, where it's just, this is a relevant industry, let's get in touch with them and see if they're interested in working with this business. And it's having a background in sales, I've never liked cold calling because I feel like I'm begging people for money essentially.
Yeah, you never want to be on the receiving end of it, so then you don't want to do it.
Yeah,
sometimes you've got to swallow your pride and just do things you don't want to do, but it's not super effective either in my experience.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, on a daily basis, we probably get like, I don't know, 150 to 200 outreach emails going for businesses. And it's, I don't know, it's so awkward. I know, like, it's the thing to do to an extent, like, but it's so weird because I'm like, this person has never heard of me. They don't know who I am. They don't know what I do. And here I am just contacting them, be like, hey, work with me.
Yeah.
Give me your money. And it's like, why in the world would anyone do that? Like, if I got a random email soliciting me for work, I'd probably be like, no. Actually, I'm probably more inclined to do that because I'm very curious about people in general. So I'm probably more inclined to respond. It's like, I don't know if it's the same over there, but like one of the current scams going around is random text messages going out to people that are like mid conversation, like, hey, it's been a while, you know.
Yeah,
like it's like a wrong number text essentially. I think two or three times now I've started those conversations, just continued them for like a day and a half just to see where it goes.
Someone's tried to scam my mum with that, pretending to be my wife. That was really bad.
They do that a lot, like especially with older people. They'll say like, oh, you know, like I'm in the hospital, I need you to send money to help me out, and like I broke my nose, that's why I don't sound the same, sort of a deal. And every single time, without fail, like it hasn't happened in quite some time now, to be fair, but like my grandparents will call me up, are you in the hospital? I'm like, no. I'm like, that's what I thought. I was like, you're not the person I would call if I was in the hospital. It's like, I'm going to call someone with money. But yeah, that, like, the, they do a thing where they'll say the IRS, like the tax collectors or whoever, need you to send them iTunes gift cards. And, like, people buy it. Like, it's,
they, it's, why the tax people would.
It's so weird. Like, I don't understand how people fall for that, but it's like scary because it's just like, I don't know. Like, when I was in high school, I was working at a grocery store, and we'd have older people like coming up all probably once or twice a week, maybe. And they'd have gift cards of some kind, and they'd be like, oh, you know, they'd buy and they'd buy cash. And we encouraged it because we had a lot, like, I was 17, 18 at the time, but we had a lot of other high school aged kids. And it was a thing where it's like, just like strike up a conversation, essentially, is what the management would say. Like, just ask them, like, oh, you getting new music or whatever? And like, that way you could try and like see if they were being scammed potentially.
Mm.
If it was a younger person, we wouldn't really. But for older people, for sure, we'd always do that because it's just like, try and prevent them from spending all of their money on gift cards and then mailing them to some random address that isn't even a government building.
Wow. Like,
it's kind of scary. But I mean, growing up, you know, your parents and grandparents would tell you, don't trust anybody on the internet. And now they're the ones trusting everybody on the internet.
It's when they pretend to be people that they're not. And if they're vaguely convincing, then that's. Mm. Yeah.
That, and like, banks will tell you so many times, like, we won't ask you for personal information. And yet people will get calls saying, hey, we're from the bank, we just need you to verify your information real quick. And people give out their information. It's like, again, like you said, like, they're even vaguely convincing, people will go through with it because they're not expecting it, I guess. But it's disheartening, to say the least.
Yeah, it's horrible.
It's only going to be worse, especially with AI. Like,
yeah, because you could fake someone's voice. Like,
exactly. Yeah. I mean, I'm working on a project now that's like a podcast, essentially, like a very short form, like 10 minutes long, where it's just, I'm doing it as a test where I'm creating like short stories and then having the AI read it and seeing people's response to it to see if they can tell if it's me or AI. And that's my, I'm going to run that for a little bit and see what happens.
Wow.
I don't know if it'll get any traction, but I find it interesting enough to give it a shot. We did it took me 15 minutes the other day. I did one where I had ChatGPT generate prompts that I took into Novel AI, had them write out short stories, and then moved that into a program called 11 Labs, which read it, like it did like a voiceover for it. And then it took me 15 minutes. And then I did the Bing, whatever the Bing AI image generator is.
Copilot, I think.
Copilot, yes, thank you. And so I had that generate some images. So I had an entire like short story with pictures with a narrator in like 15 minutes.
Wow. I'm
like, it's kind of scary that I could do this. The quality's not there. Like, you can tell when you read it, like they use a lot of the repetitive phrases and things like that. But that
the tapestry of life is usually the thing it always writes.
Yeah. But it's like in 15 minutes, like if I take another 15 minutes, I can go in and clean it up and you won't be able to tell as much. But yeah, it's nerve-wracking. I don't know if you have any concerns over that in like the animation field. I don't know if you've seen like Sora, I forget what company, OpenAI, I guess, is doing the Sora, which is like actual like videos.
Yeah, there's a few out there. There's Runway as well that does videos, and there's other things around. I saw quite an interesting one where it's more like motion tracking. But none of it is convincing yet. I think it's a way off. because there's so many nuances to animation,
especially with people. People are so hard to get spot on. Faces in particular. I know, like, the thing that people notice a lot is hands with people, but it's because, I mean, so many times AI will generate like multiple arms for people, or like they'll have too many or not enough fingers, or they'll just kind of like be mushed together. Like, it just doesn't do hands well for some reason.
Well, hands are the hardest to draw.
Yeah, but you'll have that, and then I feel like once it gets that, like faces, I feel like are the thing that people can latch onto as well, especially like close up shots, like the little subtle movements in people's faces and their eyes and things like that.
It does this uncanny, weird, thing. It doesn't. Yeah, I don't like its aesthetic.
It's like that and like fire. Fire is hard to replicate sometimes, like especially with like current day, like special effects, not even AI, like special effects in general. I feel like a lot of times it's hard to get good looking fire, which I think nowadays, I could be wrong. Again, out of my area of expertise. I think what they do is they basically film fire on like a green screen doing it or something of that nature. And then they just adjust it and clip it in to an extent.
They probably do a bit of that. There's also particle systems so you can create fire, but because it's a light source as well, which is what I guess is where the realism comes in. But if you can build a good particle system that can create pretty realistic fire. It's great with smoke. Smoke's pretty easy to do convincingly.
Okay. Yeah, I've tried getting into like Blender and like 3D modeling and like animation software briefly. And it was so in depth. It was overwhelming. It's one of the things where I'd have to actually sit down and take a lot of time to really just get the hang of the basics of it before I could dive in and really try and make anything for myself.
Blender's quite fun. It's a lot easier than 3D software used to be. But I don't know it well. I mean, I just play.
Yeah, I get like I have the barest knowledge of it in general, but that seemed to be the easiest one. Not necessarily easy to get into, but the most resources surrounding it as far as like tutorials and things like that. And it's like open source. Like, there's a lot of plugins and you can download so many assets for it and everything like that. It's just file types. All of them, I imagine you could get at the different assets for, but yeah, it's super in depth, especially for like high quality as in like realism or like super detailed models. Like, it's fascinating, but very, very difficult for me to understand.
Yeah, it's tricky, but I think it's got a lot more user friendly than previous bits of software.
Is there one software in particular you use for your animation?
So I mainly use a program called Toon Boom Harmony, which is, it's kind of a 2D, where it is a 2D puppet type animation thing. So you create joints and things for the characters. Interesting. And so it's a lot less work than if you were drawing them everything frame by frame. And I use After Effects as well, which is better known. Toon Boom is great, but it's got a bit more of a learning curve.
I feel like I've actually heard of that before. Cause I know I was looking into this at the same time I was looking into the like 3D modeling in general. So that's cool. So I'm gonna break it down. So you basically make a skeleton for a character, sketch over it, and then next frame you're just dragging the skeleton essentially to adjust the character's movements?
Kind of. So you would draw all the elements. So you draw the eyeballs, the or the pupils, the eyeballs, the nose, the ears. Every single element would be on a separate layer, effectively. And they are all on what's called pegs, that you can move the pegs around. So you move the ear to the right or to the left. So you create a character out of all these different bits, and then you can kind of shape and deform parts of them so they can do different things. And then you do that. You So effectively, it is still frame by frame, but you've got you're manipulating something.
Mm-hmm. So you're just moving the pieces around instead of redoing it every single time.
Yeah.
I see. Okay. No, that's cool. Yeah. I imagine old school style. They literally did sketch it frame by frame, every single frame, I imagine.
Yes.
Back in the day.
So what you do is you pick your keyframe.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got someone walking from one side of the room to the other, or, mm-hmm. Certainly a better example, someone sat there with a glass of water and they're drinking it, you'd have the frame of it on the table, the frame of it in the mouth. And so that'd be your, and then you'd work out maybe the one in between, what do they do? What do you do when you pick up a glass? What's your, and then once you've got those key ones, then you would work out the ones in between. Okay. So you wouldn't just go one, next one, next one, next one.
Mm, that makes sense. So you know where you're going to, that way you can kind of compartmentalize the actual movements.
Yes.
I see. That makes sense. Yeah, it's,
and that's still how we do it today.
Mm-hmm. There's, I don't want to phrase this. There's been a shift in like animation style over the years, and there's going to be, it's just like a matter of taste and, you know, it's subjective, but like you even see it during like certain cartoons, like SpongeBob SquarePants. I remember, I mean, that's a show I watched briefly as a child.
It's a great show.
Just because my sister had it on, and it is a good show. But like, I remember seeing a thing about like the transformation of his character over the years and like the different art styles they went through, where it's almost simplified, where they remove more detailed elements and just break it down to make it, like I said, more simple looking.
Mm.
Is there a reason for that? Like that you could think of where maybe there's a, like why the transition to that sort of thing, just the ease of drawing it more quickly.
It probably, the less you've got, the easier it is. There's probably aesthetic choices too. Mm. It's interesting with Jazz Cow that the cow has developed from, it's kind of got more refined and simple. A lot of the characters have got more refined and simple over time.
Mm.
And as I was animating a character recently, I was like, oh, this is so much easier than the previous iteration of the same character.
Yeah. A lot of, like I said, it's not something I have as much information on currently, but like in general, like from what I've seen, like a lot of animation is like, I don't know if snappier is the right word, but it's very quick movements, hiding that way. You're not animating so many frames in between. It seems maybe because like the comparison I use is like back in the day, like the Jungle Book, like the Disney animated film, like that animation is so smooth and detailed. There's a particular shot of Mowgli just walking through the jungle. I think it's right at the beginning of the film, where it's just him walking through the jungle. And like, just as he's walking, it's super smooth and crisp and like kicking the ground with his foot. And it's like the animation is just so, so sleek.
Yeah.
And it's very different. Not saying that today's like animation is bad. It's just very different, like comparatively.
Yeah. It's really, really subtle. Yeah. There was on Jungle Book, it was Milk Carl is the animator. Mm. And he was one of these kind of genius animators that had been around for a very long time and was one of the gurus that everyone looks up to. So I think in many ways it was the height of that kind of realistic Disney aesthetic. Mm. A lot of the snappier stuff is partly because it's funnier, but I think partly it's budget, partly it's the kind of things that the short attention span, kind of quick stuff. You still get the fluid animation like the Jungle Book today, but it's maybe not as common.
Yeah. I know they, people bring up, especially on like Reddit, they'll show off the Jungle Book and I think it's Robin Hood maybe.
Oh,
it's the same animation, just skins, like the movements, but reskin for the different films. Correct me if I'm wrong. Isn't some of that crap? I've lost the phrasing where they're taking live action and just sketching over rotoscoping. Yeah. Isn't that what they did for a lot of it as well?
They certainly did. Disney did a lot of rotoscoping, and
okay.
I saw a film the other day in the cinema, and I was like, oh, that's a lot of rotoscoping in there, and it kind of floats a bit if it looks too rotoscoped. You get that with Snow White. But I don't know what was rotoscoped. I don't think those were rotoscoped. But I don't know.
Yeah, I'm just curious.
But when they do it, certainly those Disney ones, they're not doing it very literally. They're using it as a very, just very heavy reference. Yeah.
Yeah.
When it's done really literally, it floats and it looks weird. It's just a bit.
Yeah, it's a. There was a program I used at one point, Absinthe. I don't know if you've ever heard of that.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
It's quite fun.
I tried out rotoscoping with that at one point. And again, I have no artistic talent whatsoever. Fortunately, all I was doing was tracing it. So I'd sit down and shoot live action and just trace over it. And a company I worked with had done like a Who We Are style video. And it's just them talking. It'd be like cut, you know, splicing of them being like interviewed, like, you know, and then it would cut to a couple of shots of them like in the process of working. And it was simple enough. And it was like a minute and a half long, roughly. I was like, oh, this would be a good test one. And even that, it's like there's so many instances where, you know, you enter your keyframe and then it just connects it. And it's been a while since I did this. But if I remember correctly, just scene by scene, I broke it down into like 5 seconds, essentially. Sketch over one of them and then let it go, run it through, and it just reanimates it based on the background video.
Because it's tracking the face or whatever.
It was actually easy. I'm doing air quotes here. It was easy to like understand what was going on. But even so, it's still difficult because like when people are talking, their mouth is moving, their eyes are blinking, and it's very easy for it to lose track of where things are. And so there is a lot of effort that has to go into just redoing bits of the animation over and over again. But it was fascinating to watch it happen. And that's probably the easiest way to rotoscope something, I imagine, currently, because your computer is essentially doing huge portions of it for you.
Yeah.
I was trying to find the guy's name, Joel Haver. That's who I was thinking of. He's a YouTuber that does that. Like all of his videos are rotoscoped.
I've not heard of him. Joel Haver.
I've seen maybe a dozen of his videos, and he actually does a video. That's how I found out about Absinthe, where he did like a whole video on like how I animated this video, and he breaks down the entire process. And it's him, you know, filming scenes, you know, on a like live action, and like how he'll dress up to like make his his physical form bigger to fit the shape he needs in order to match up with, you know, whatever animated character he's trying to make. And it's like I said, it is fascinating. He also talks about how long it takes him to do every single video. And I'm like, yep, I could never do that.
I'll check him out. It'd be fun.
It is interesting. He does a lot of like, as of late, I've seen a number of them where it's him doing promotional videos for like video games and things like that. But he did one, I forget. It was like quite a bit longer. I don't remember how long. It was like 15 minutes long, maybe, which seems like a lot for that style of video. Like, imagine it's quite a bit of animating to do and reworking it and going back through and making sure everything matches up properly.
Yeah.
But anyway, I've digressed too much. let's cycle back to Jazz Cow. What was the start of this project for you?
So it started many, many years ago with a group of us having a good laugh. And in fact, regularly, most nights of the week, we were just laughing until the early hours about everything and nothing. And we had this, a book called, I think it was Cartoon Encyclopedia. And we were just flicking through that, laughing about stuff. And during that conversation, this idea of this jazz playing cow came up. And one of the guys, he picks up a sketchbook and he starts drawing this cow, and we're all just laughing away. And then we later think, ah, no, there's something in this. So we develop a short, and that went into a festival. And then we developed a pitch, and then that went, we showed that to a number of broadcasters. And then it didn't really go anywhere. And then years later, with a comedy scriptwriter, we redeveloped it. And so that's the kind of story of where it went. And it was always this thing that the cow is, he stands between worlds, because he's in the human world, but he's not human. He plays jazz. He's on the edge of society, and he's a resistance fighter. So he is reluctantly leading his misfits and free thinkers in rebellion to the kind of technocracy, the kind of big tech kind of world. Mm-hmm. And that's developed more and more, because since we had the idea, this world of kind of tech and algorithms has just got bigger and bigger and bigger. So that really is the world we're living in now.
How do you go about choosing an art style, like an animation style, when you're doing this? Because I imagine it can differ depending on the theme that you're going with for a particular project. If you're going with a more serious theme, you might go with the more, you know, detailed, obviously darker colors, maybe a more detailed facial animation, whereas a lighthearted cartoon might be more rounded and bright colors and so on and so forth.
So
maybe I'm wrong.
No, you're absolutely right. Every animation should look different. It should be, the story should drive how it looks and what it feels like. And with this, there is a tension, because it's ridiculous, the whole idea of a cow playing jazz. Jazz is like complex music to master, and so actually there's a kind of, it's in a slightly noir world. So some of the humor comes from the kind of contrast of a cow and the absurdity of that, but in this kind of slightly serious scenario.
Yeah.
And so for this, there's big influence of film noir. Art Deco gets a bit of a look in. There's various artists that have put in their influence. There's the Blue Note album covers. You can see influences of that kind of cutout feel in some of the buildings. So it's got all sorts of different things have come in and influenced it. And I think over time, as it's matured, those ideas have kind of melted together and become a lot more coherent.
Yeah. I'm assuming you do like tests essentially, where it's like, how do we like this animation style? How do we like this art style? And then you just keep re-implementing them in different ways to see.
Yeah. See,
you get to the point where everyone agrees, like, yeah, this is good.
Yeah. So yeah, there's that going on. And then of the character designs, there was originally designed by one person, developed by someone else, and then further developed by someone else. And so it gets better at each iteration.
Yeah. When you're working on a project, do you have different people or different teams working on different sections of a sim, like let's say you're working on an animated episode of a show, for example, are you gonna have different people and different teams working on different scenes and like different parts of the episode? And then if so, how do those all come together at the end to mesh together well?
So because we're just raising money for the pilot, that's all we'll do initially. Hopefully, hopefully we can do that. Hopefully the money will come in, and hopefully beyond that we can do more. But it will be broken down. Every scene will be broken down, and we're working with a team in Argentina who have a little animation studio. They've done lots of great work on Netflix, various TV shows and things. Yes. And those guys will handle that, but we'll probably be sending various scenes from the storyboard to them in bits rather than the whole lot. I imagine depends. I'm not quite sure how we'll structure it, but we will have the whole storyboard and map that out and agree that. And then which order the scenes are done are going to be to do with other factors. But we'll record the voices before all of that anyway.
Interesting. Is it similar to, I forget the exact terms, like pre-effects on like a film where they do very, very basic style, like 3D modeling essentially, send it over and then say, hey, here's like essentially how it'll play out, and then if they approve, you go back in and actually add in the details, sort of?
Yeah. So it'll be like a traditional storyboard, but timed out to the voices, timed out to the music, or some of the music. Yeah. And so you get a feel for, oh, this is the shape of the thing. And and each scene will be exported as a different file. So then they'd have that file to work from.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting. Yeah, I imagine you want to map it out as best as possible before you actually go in and fill out the details. That way you're not second guessing yourself or having to make things up on the fly, so to speak.
Yeah. Don't want anything made up on the fly. You want to have unless there's some brilliant ideas, but we want to have with the storyboarding, you want to just keep going back and forward until you get that right. And it's really telling the story as well as it can. Sometimes you'd be like, oh, that's an amazing shot, but that's going to be too expensive. Let's swap it out for others.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Sometimes it's going to be, oh, if we change this, it could be funnier. All those kind of considerations.
You mentioned something being an expensive shot. How do you figure out the cost of like animation in general?
Time. So you make a prediction based upon how much time you'll think it will be to do. So things that take ages are crowd scenes. The more things in a shot, the more time it takes, the more complex things that happen. So if you had some kind of crazy camera move.
I see. Because you're going to have to make sure everything is consistent across the movement of the panning of the cameras.
Yes.
How that works out. I see. Okay, that makes sense. Because I know they'll talk about, you know, oh, this is a super expensive FX shot to you know, create for this short little scene, like a, I don't know, like Game of Thrones or something, where just having the dragons flying in the background and landing.
Mm.
You know, I know one of the things they talked about was one of the reasons they didn't show the wolves as much or the dire wolves later on is because they were super expensive. And I guess again, not having experience in it, my guess is just because of their fur, like their animated dogs, people are super familiar with them. So it's harder to make them look realistic, especially if you have characters interacting with them.
Yeah, everything you have to create is always cheaper to just film what exists in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that makes sense. Yeah, like you said, the dragons obviously like resemble lizards to a certain extent, so you still have to make the scales look realistic. Yeah, I mean, the faces you have a bit more liberty on, to an extent, but you know, the more fantastical the creature, I guess the more liberty you have with it, or, you know, not even just creatures, just things in general, the more fantastic and non-realistic it is, the less people can preemptively form an image in their head of what it should look like.
But it does have to follow the laws of physics, how it moves, the lighting, and all of these things need to fit the lighting of the world it's in.
Makes sense. Yeah, yeah. So I guess, too, depending on how many things it's interacting with as well, you have to worry about the different shadows and elements and dust and whatever. Especially for, like, again, going back to the dragons in Game of Thrones, you know, they're flying on over in the sky and landing on the ground. Now you have all the dust particles being kicked up. You have to focus on getting the characters that are riding them off properly so it looks realistic and natural. Because I think in real life, they're just riding, like, essentially a giant, you know, bull machine.
Mm,
to an extent. Probably. The mechanical bull sort of thing. I forget. I've seen behind the scenes things. I think that's sort of what it is.
Yeah, it's probably a great, bright green one.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, yeah, just a little section they're sitting in. But yeah, there's a lot going into those alone. Even from my perspective of someone who has nothing to do with that, like, I can think of however many different things you need to take into account. And I'm sure there's 24 other things I don't even think of. Yeah, that need to be taken into effect, you know, like the weight of a character as they land and how that affects everything around them. But what would you say is the hardest thing for you to do as an animator?
The hardest. It's both the easiest and the hardest. I was going to say doing like characters, doing a character coming alive is easy in the sense that you're not doing crazy special effects or so you've got none of those things to think about, but actually the acting to make sure that the emotion is really coming across, the eyebrow moves at the right position that makes you feel, that's the hardest.
Just conveying like the emotion.
Yeah.
From a 2D character. That makes sense.
Because that's the emotional heart of everything you do. So you know how flashy a shot is.
Yeah.
It's fun, but no one's moved by that. No one.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so that would be the thing. It takes the most skill.
I see. Maybe you said, I know you mentioned, like, what is your favorite part about animating then? Just coming up with the creative side of things, or is it the being able to see it from the viewer's perspective and watching people react to it?
So for animating itself, it is successfully creating emotion that then makes, that moves people. But for me, it's much more the big picture of a story coming together and having a team working really well and it just working as one whole and people really loving it. That's the thing I like the most.
Hmm. No, that makes sense. Like I said, I mean, the main thing I do is working with small businesses and small content creators and helping them get things started. So like the main payoff for me is like working with an individual and like building their website for them and launching the website. It's like, hey, we did it. You know, there's some companies I work with who are already established and it's almost less rewarding because there's no crossing the finish line, so to speak. You know, yeah, there's super small little goals like, hey, we did this task today or whatever. You know, we updated this, but there's no big payoff.
Yeah.
You know, finishing an entire project because it's just, they're at the point where everything's just an ongoing thing. Whereas with some people, it's like, hey, we finished your website. Hey, we edited this video and got it, you know, good to go for you and, you know, all those sorts of things.
Yeah.
You know, I'm very much like a checklist guy.
I think we all are, aren't we?
Yeah, I get to write something down and check it off. I'm like, yes. Like, that's the most satisfying part of it. But yeah, there's definitely aspects where it's just like, hey, we need you to monitor our advertising. I'm like, I can do that. That's fine. There's nothing satisfying about that to me, though.
Yeah.
Because it's just like me conveying information and like condensing it into an easily understandable format.
Yeah.
There is nothing satisfying about that to me whatsoever.
Yeah. The only thing that I'd find satisfying about that is the feeling I've done the best job I can. That's it. There's nothing more.
Yeah. It's part of like when I got started doing like the freelance work, it was exciting because I'm like, oh, I get to, you know, obviously I'm not fully self-employed yet, but there's the mindset of like, oh, I'm going to be able to be my own boss and whatever. And, you know, all these things I do for fun, I get to turn into a career potentially. And then, like I said, it's like, oh, but, you know, I'm having to manage all this stuff and keep it organized, like all the minutiae. I do see why like content creators like YouTubers and things get burnt out because they think it's going to be fun. And then once it becomes a job, it's like, I have to do this.
Yeah.
It's like, there is no break where I get to have the cool off, you know, period or whatever, where I just get to step back and appreciate it. It's like, nope, just staying on the grind.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have a similar thing with like the animation side of things.
Well, I don't, but I will do. So during the Jazz Cow campaign, I've got to push out content in order to get people to sign up to the mailing lists and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So that's
always fun.
Yeah, it's that thing of I've got to feed the algorithm, and the which is ironic because Jazz Cow was fighting the algorithms. And if there's one message, it's that we should be resisting these algorithms. And there's me desperately like trying to feed more things in order to try and get people to look at our website, which is jazzcow.co.uk. And it's just like this push. Has anyone signed up today? All of that. And that's exactly what we're fighting against. But so, yeah.
Yeah, it can be disheartening for people, like, especially starting out with stuff. Like, there's a number of people I work with where it's either building a website from scratch for them or getting them started on social media, like just having like an Instagram that they post to at least semi-regularly, especially if it's not something they made a habit out of. Or I'm like, just take, you know, on a Monday, you know, whatever, if it, like, I'll use like a boutique, for example, you know, just go in, take, you know, 20 photos, you know, just like 2-3 photos of a couple of products that you want to, you know, 2-3 photos each of a couple of products you want to promote. I'm like, that way you have 20 photos and, you know, that covers the 7 days of the week. And then just do that every Monday and you'll have a backlog of catalog and a back catalog of content in no time. And then a lot of times what'll happen, unfortunately, is they'll either forget or put off, you know, getting these, you know, photos and stuff. And I'm like, we ran out of content again. So there's nothing being uploaded to your Instagram and the momentum you've built up is, you know, dying off. And they're like, oh, I got to get around to that. I'm like, it's like, just make it a habit, you know, just especially when you're trying to build up like a social media following, consistency is key. And it's not something, especially like a lot of older people, like not even like retirement age, like people in their 30s and 40s, well, not 30s maybe anymore, but like 40s and 50s, you know, they're not quite as invested in social media as younger generations. So it's like they're less likely to be constantly checking Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, whatever, Snapchat. And it is a hassle keeping up on them sometimes to keep sending me content.
And that's why people burn out, because we're not designed to have these like mini dopamine rushes of just, oh, have I had a message? Oh. Mm-hmm. And that, those kind of, all of that adds up to where this short-term like rush is not good for us.
Yeah.
And so it's, and no wonder, like, you've got a whole load of people depressed because it's
feeding. I was actually talking to someone today about this, about the way marketing changes over time, where you look for, like, you know, the baby boomer generation here, the whole marketing scheme around them was like having it your way. Like, that's where Burger King got their slogan from, was have it your way, was the baby boomer generation. And all the marketing was catered towards, you know, have things how you want them. Like, everything is catered towards your tastes. And, you know, fast forward to current day, you know, so much marketing is based around this, like, extreme individualism of, like, you know, that, and, like, you're the next big thing, you know, you're the next, you know, you're the next social media star. Like, it's all about everyone being famous on the internet, you know, in a lot of aspects. They do that with phones. Like, I don't know how many different phone commercials they have nowadays where it's, like, based around the camera and how they have all these tools to make social media style content. You know, there's a commercial for, I think it's Samsung, maybe, I could be wrong, where it's the specific commercial is a woman filming her son playing, I think, football, and it's her sprinting down the sideline and recording him on her phone. And the whole point of it is, like, the stabilization of the camera. Mm. And it's, you know, it's literally based around social media. Like, that's where a lot of content, or, you know, marketing is social media, and, like, becoming an influencer of sorts. You know, you see it in fashion brand. I use fashion to cover, like, clothing in general, but it's like, you know, stand out in the crowd, you know, this and that, like, everything is like them taking photos of themselves. Even on like insurance commercials, they do it to an extent. And it's fascinating to see how the marketing is tooled towards the different generations.
I was hearing about Instagram face. So the kind of fake filters that girls, and increasingly boys as well, are using to look a particular way that is a good look for Instagram.
Yeah.
Is not a good look in real life.
No.
And people are getting plastic surgery to match the Instagram look.
It's very weird.
Which show is just so sad. And people are changing themselves in a way that doesn't look good in real life.
And there's definitely the really Kardashian strange face going on. Is how I refer to it as, where, like, the Kardashians got famous. And then over a couple of years, like, you see, like, other celebrities adopting similar, they get surgery to adopt similar facial structures and so on and so forth. And it's very interesting to see. Yeah, I don't know. There is definitely, I don't know, it's like you're saying, there's the plastic surgery to change to, like, basing real life on fake life, essentially, is bizarre to me. I don't know if I'm an outlier in my millennial age group, or maybe it's just we missed the cut, thankfully. But I've noticed it with like social skills, where you will be out and about with people. Like, I worked at a university, it's been almost 10 years ago now, actually. But even then, like, we'd go down to, like, the student bookstore and, you know, hang out there, and, like, you'd see kids on their phones all the time, whatever. But then just down the street, they had a couple of pubs, and there'd be, like, college kids in there hanging out together all on their phones. I'm like, you can't even be in person talking to each other. They're, like, sending messages, like, goofy messages and pictures back and forth to each other while they're together. And here's a perfect example. Literally this week on Tuesday, we went out to a Jersey Mike's sub shop for dinner. We were just picking it up, and I needed to go to the register to pay for a drink while I was there. And I asked these people if they were in line, and they didn't know how to respond. And it was bizarre to me that people, like, don't know how to, like, you know, conversate in public. Like, it was, you know, I'm definitely more talkative than most people in public, but I don't think that's a strange scenario to be asked if you're in line or not.
Yeah. Are they COVID kids as well?
Well, they would have, I mean, they're college aged. So, I mean, they would be,
yeah,
we'll say 20 for middle ground.
So, but, yeah, and COVID was what, 3 years
2020.
Ago? 2020. Yeah.
4 years ago.
4 years ago. So they've had their, if you think those years where they would have learned how to be an adult and learned to be socialized was in isolation.
I see what you're saying now. Okay. Yeah. I don't know. It's just, like I said, that particular scenario is, you know, like you said, with the COVID isolationism. But even, like I said, like almost 6 years ago, we'll say, when I was at the university, even then, the fact that they had lacked social skills, and there's, I mean, every generation is going to have an aspect of that for sure. You're just going to have groups of people that are like that. But people just not knowing how to communicate in person, where it's just all online. Like, people not, like, how many people date in person anymore instead of like meeting up with people on dating apps? I wonder what the percentage is. I'd be fascinated to see.
Yeah, dating apps are probably the vast majority.
And I would assume so.
And they have a built-in problem because, so I was hearing about this the other day, that dating apps don't want people to get together because they want people to
be...
They'll stop using the app.
Yeah.
So they're not incentivized for the reason that people are joining.
Mm-hmm.
And that's... yeah, that's really bad.
Well, yeah, it's not based around relationships, is based around like hooking up, essentially, just like short-term relationships,
which is gonna make everyone miserable.
Yeah, but like, I mean, I met my fiance in person. Like, I've never used a dating app, but most people I know have met, you know, I've met people through dating apps. And I'm like, I wonder how this works out long term, because there aren't any long-term relationships that were based on dating apps for the most part, because they haven't been around long enough. Obviously there's online dating. I consider that slightly different though, I think.
It's not the same as the swipe thing.
Yeah. Which is 8 years old, maybe.
And that's been, that's proven to have to do crazy things to people's minds.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm curious as to like long term how that works out for people, because how, like you said, it's not made for long term relationships. Otherwise, the apps would all die out. I'm curious to see like the people who have met on there that do stay together, how long it actually works out, because they're not matching up because of any real chemistry necessarily. It's, hey, this app made a decision that you have some shared interest, maybe. Even though people in general lie on those all the time, I know.
And their pictures are fake. Everything's fake.
There are so many people that just not even dating. There are so many people in general I know who will like on their internet profiles, like Facebook, whatever, will talk about, like, oh, I love the outdoors. I like adventuring. It's like, have you ever gone? Like, when was the last time you went outside of town? like you are not an adventurer. You're not an outdoorsman. You don't climb. You don't go like canoeing or hike. Like, sometimes you go outside in order to get somewhere else. That is your adventure. These fictional versions of themselves that people make.
Yeah.
It's hilarious.
Well, that's the mission that JazzCal's fighting against. So,
yes,
that is our world.
It's all come full circle. We've circled back to the main topic. But yeah, it's weird. It's a weird scenario how everyone is fully connected via the internet and yet so disconnected from reality. It's a fascinating contradiction. It's really weird. I know. I even based on what I do, which is all online, like my whole career is based around the internet. When I'm not working, I'm not on the internet basically at all. Like, I don't want anything to do with it. I don't care what other people are doing generally, which is hypocritical since I do a podcast. but I don't care about it. I'm not looking at Facebook and Instagram. I don't have personal accounts for anything other than Twitter, which I use for networking. But I don't care what other people are doing. I don't really want other people to know what I'm doing generally. Like the way people will post like, oh, I'm here for the day. It's like, oh, cool. Now I know where you're at. That's creepy. Like, I don't know.
But podcasting, I think, is a bit different. I think YouTube conversations as well are a bit different as well, because they are a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as you forget you're being recorded, it stops being contrived.
Fair enough. Yeah, social media posts in general are a bit more one-sided, even though you have commenters and things like that. It's, if you're collaborating with someone else, it is a bit different. But it's, yeah, the strangeness to me comes from people posting all of their mundane activities throughout the day and every thought that pops into their head, and then other people feeling obligated to comment on it because they also have nothing else going on, I guess. I don't know.
I used to test opinions out, just throw things out, and I used to, and I wasn't particularly committed to stuff, but just throw things out, just get a feel for, and also to spark interesting conversations.
Mm-hmm.
But then there was a period where it's like, no, you can't do that anymore. People take you literally, and the fun is gone.
Maybe this is me being a grumpy old man, essentially. Like, I remember, like, years ago, like, YouTube felt a lot more like a community than a business like it does currently.
Yeah.
And it was a lot more back and forth between the creators and the commenters, if you want to frame it that way. But nowadays, like even back then, like, people would upload content like, oh, hey, it's something cool I did today, whatever. Just to upload it and have the video out there is almost like just documentation, so to speak, of like their lives and what's going on. Or even if they're creating like narrative driven content, it was more natural. Whereas today, I feel like so many people get into social media because like, I want to be an influencer. I want to make money on this. And it's so much more business minded and analytical. Like, so many people look at the stats of it and everything. Like, they're way more in depth on it because they're so focused on succeeding at it. And it's weird. It's weird to me. I'm a crotchety old man.
Well, the thing is, I've got sucked into that to a certain extent because I'm trying to promote a project.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't enjoy any of that. I don't like the fact that now if you on Twitter and Instagram and all these things, if you post a link,
mm-hmm.
they will show your post to fewer people because they want you to stay on the platform. But
then that
makes the platform less useful because you'll have fewer links, and links are what is the internet. Yeah. And I'm trying to get people to sign up to my mailing list. And how do I do that if it's not going to show me when I mention the link?
Yeah, it's a lot of the things are counterintuitive because, like I said, everyone wants you to stay on their website. I mean, that's the way YouTube is formatted as well. Like, you know, the longer you can keep people on your video, like, it's, you know, you'll get rewarded more for that. You know, if people click off your video after 5 seconds, they're going to show less people your video than people that watch the full 5 minutes or whatever. You know, if you have a 10-minute video, you know, you get that mid-roll ad or whatever, and just you're rewarded for keeping people on the individual platforms, which from a business perspective, I get it. Like, obviously you want people to stay on your platform and not go elsewhere. Why would you incentivize, you know, having content on your platform that drives people away? It doesn't make sense from a business point of view.
Although from a functional
point of view, it, you know, I get it though the other way too.
But then I used to go to Twitter a lot more because of links people shared. So I don't go on as much. But
Twitter in general has gone downhill on the functionality side of things. You look at like what's trending and like the hashtags and things, and it's irrelevant. Like, so much of the content is wildly irrelevant. because you have people posting things and then just seeing what's currently trending, putting all those phrases into the post. And so now, you know, each hashtag is useless.
Mm.
And it's originally there was moderation for that, and it's been removed. It's so unfortunately Twitter is a real mess to work with and optimize the content for at this point.
That's which, interesting.
Yeah, it's a real mess.
I know that most Twitter posts I look at it. Twitter's honest. It tells you how many people it's shown something to. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, not many.
It's weird. It's really weird too, because the way the metric works is strange. It counts it if someone just scrolls by it. Like look at what is Tucker Carlson.
Mm.
You know, famous,
yeah,
quote unquote journalist, allegedly. But like he did an interview with somebody. I can't remember. Maybe it was like Alex Jones or something. He did an interview with somebody, and they talked about how he had like 300 million views in a day. But what they don't explain is that anytime someone scrolls by that video, it counts as a view, and people are reposting his original, like retweeting it essentially. So you could scroll by his post and someone reposting it back to back, and that counts as two views.
Mm.
Even if you don't sit there and watch the video. So you have this like this vacuum of people where they all follow each other, and so you're going to see the exact same post 20 times in a row, and all of a sudden he has 20 views from one person who hasn't even watched the video yet. And so almost any platform is going to do this. Facebook does the exact same thing with their advertising. It's beyond frustrating. But they just want to make themselves seem better than they are to make more money from advertisers. You know, like one of the things with Facebook is like with Facebook advertising is it'll show you like, oh, here's how many impressions the ad got. And it's like, okay, but it was, you know, one little ad in the middle of the feed that somebody swiped past. It's not really helpful.
Hmm.
You know, I don't know. They're not lying to you, but at the same time, they're presenting it to you in a way that seems more beneficial than it really is. It's frustrating.
I find them quite dishonest. I did some Facebook ads for someone a while back,
mm-hmm.
and it was ended up being really stressful because I couldn't stop the ad. And it was sending out the wrong ad, which wasn't what which wasn't what I'd set up, and it wouldn't let me stop it, and it was using up someone's money, and I had to restart my computer. There's no way of contacting them. The help
there's no support for them whatsoever, basically at this point.
And they treat you like trash, because eventually I emailed someone. They got back like a couple of weeks later, and I'd explained the problem. They say, do you have screen recordings of what happened? I'm like, of course not. I was panicking that you were stealing money.
Yeah. No, it's one of those situations where they're too big to fail, where it's like, we don't need you. Like, we don't care if you hate us. We don't need your money. It's not enough to affect us in any way. And the one thing they do like almost blatantly lie about is conversions. Like the number of times people click through and go to your website, like, it's not accurate at all. Like, cause you can track it, you know, you can set up the pixels, like you can track it on your end. Like it doesn't add up, and they'll tell you, oh, you're not tracking it properly. There's no way like four other sources are all telling me the exact same thing. And Facebook is different, but Facebook is right. And they're all wrong. Like, it's just not, there's no way.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's super frustrating.
I don't trust them one little bit.
No, unfortunately I work with them daily on a daily basis for all sorts of clients, because there's so many people that use Instagram and Facebook, and so if you want to drum up traffic from those audiences, you kind of have to. But it feels like you're being robbed, because you kind of are.
You are. I couldn't believe it when I couldn't stop the ad. and it was costing money.
Yeah. Yeah. It's obnoxious. And then a lot of times too, like, not, this isn't Facebook specific, but there's a lot of instances where things are made overly complicated just for the sake of confusion.
Yes.
To make it easier for them to make money. Google does that a lot, where like, if you run Google ads, you'll get a, like an ads account manager. And so like, they'll be like, oh, you should do this. This will help your ads. And what they don't say is that it's going to cost you hundreds, if not thousands, of extra dollars. Like, their whole goal is to get you to spend more money. Hmm. They're helping you set your ads up slightly better at times, but like, I don't know how many times, like, I'll be working for a client and they'll be like, oh, set this up. And I'll talk to their Google Ads account manager and like ask them like, how, like, what have they been doing? Like, how have they been running this? And like, well, they've been doing it this way and this way. And like, that doesn't even make sense for them as a business. Like, that doesn't benefit them. And I look like they've been spending like $5,000 a month. And it's just like, for small businesses, like for big businesses, it's different, but like a small business, I'm like, this is way too much money. And like, this is set up in a way where they're getting a lot of people seeing their ads that are not even remotely relevant. And it annoys me. I'm like, I get it. The account manager is just doing their job, but it's, their job is to be dishonest or misleading. It's really frustrating, because then I have to come back and basically not argue, but like explain to the client and be like, hey, listen, I'm radically changing all your advertising up because they tricked you. And then the person gets upset because it sounds like I'm telling them that they're dumb and fell for a scam, which isn't necessarily wrong, but it's not, you know, it's annoying. Or sometimes I come in and I set something up and then they get in touch with the Google accounts manager independently of me working on it. And then they're like, oh, well, they said I should do it this way. And I'm like, no, don't do that. And they're like, well, they work for Google, so I'm going to trust them. And it makes me look bad when all I'm trying to do is set it up in a way that works well for them.
This Facebook thing made me look bad.
Yeah. It's
And you're completely powerless. That's the thing.
Yeah. It's annoying working with massive tech companies.
With no help.
Fortunately, we're only going to have to deal with AI going forward, which I'm sure will be way more straightforward and,
of course,
and honorable.
Of course. It'll be so human.
Yeah. I can't imagine, you know, like whenever you call customer support lines for like cell phone service or whatever, I have to imagine that's not going to change in the slightest. It can't get any worse than it already is, surely. It's just going to sound better. It's going to sound more human is all.
We'll find out.
Who knows? But anyway, we're a little over an hour here. I don't know if there's anything else in specific you wanted to touch on. You did mention, I know on your original Reddit post, I read you were award winning.
Yes.
How did that come about?
So a few of our films and animations have won awards. And so I'm just thinking of one of them that we entered it into a competition. It was a film festival for kids films or something. And we won in that. Nice. I worked with my brother and he's just won a music video, best music video award.
Nice.
We've got, over the years, we've clocked up a number of awards for different things we've done.
That's awesome. I've never won an award, but I've never entered anything.
Enter some. It's a way to feel validated.
I need to do it. There's a thing I've noticed with like some podcasters where they'll promote like, oh, and you know, top 10 in whatever. And the top 10 list that they're in is like unbelievably specific.
Yes.
It's like top 10 horror podcasts narrated by a man over the age of 40 from New York. And it's like, okay. It's like so niche. And I'm like, okay, kudos. Fair enough. If I'm going to be entered in anything, it's probably going to be like writing related, because that's the only thing I'm closest to actually creating content and publishing, I guess you'd say. But The only time I've ever been entered in like a contest where I could have won an award, I guess, would have been when I was in school. We had a, I don't even remember what they called it, but essentially we made a music video, and it was myself and two of my classmates, and it was like an anti-bullying music video, and we filmed it, edited it, took it to this like technology fair essentially, and we lost. We came in third. There was only two people. There was all sorts of other technology related things there, but they narrowed us down to like the video editing or some category of that nature. And we were matched up with two other people and we came in third, and we got to go around afterwards and look at what other people did. And the girl that won, I don't know if I have to assume she had help, because we were like 8 years old at the time. She had a DVD. The DVD had an entire menu system. It had like DVD extras. And we're like, how? There's no way this 8-year-old girl did this all on herself. Surely. I have no idea. Maybe she did. If so,
wow.
Fantastic. But I was just like, huh. I feel like we were in a different bracket of competition
here. Yeah, it's not fair, is it?
I was like, I didn't have access to those sort of tools. I was using Windows Movie Maker. But. No, that's awesome. That's really cool. You win awards for that. Hopefully you win a future awards for Jazzcat.
That'd be great. So the only way that's going to happen is if people support us. So,
yeah. Speaking of which, where can people go to support you and check out the work?
So jazzcat.co.uk. And if people sign up there, they'll get onto the mailing list. And then we can keep you up to date. And we're launching on May the 1st on Kickstarter. And you can also find us on Substack. So it's jazzcow.substack.com. Yeah, so they're the main things. If you search for me, you can see John Lumgay. You can see me, my social media. You can follow that. But yeah, the key thing is jazzcow.co.uk.
Nice. I just resisted the algorithm by signing up for the newsletter. So
thank you. There we go.
Now I'm part of the algorithm that I'm resisting.
Yes. It's all meta.
Yes. But no, awesome. I'm looking forward to seeing where you go with this. And yeah, everyone be sure to go support it. We like supporting independent artists and content creators here. And go check out deadjesterproductions.live. Got links to all of our stuff on there. And thank you so much for coming on, man. I really had a fun time. I like peeling back the curtain and getting people's inputs and techniques and all sorts of information on these sorts of things.
Oh, I hope it's been interesting to everyone listening.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much, and thank you everyone for listening. It's been episode number 217 of the Deadjust Productions podcast. We'll see you guys next time.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.